Okay, hello, and welcome to episode number 108 of the Three Drinks In podcast. I'm your host, Vince. Over there is Phil.
Hey.
There's Phil. This is one of our Shaken Not Stirred episodes, talking about On Her Majesty's Secret Service. We don't have a guest this week. I want to remind you that we are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. Just search for Three Drinks In podcast, and you'll easily find us. Press that subscribe button so you never miss an episode, and while you're there, leave a review or at the very least a rating. We'd really appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter at Three Drinks In Pod. That's at the number three, Drinks In Pod. Three Drinks In Podcast, all one word, on Instagram and then on Facebook. And questions and concerns can be sent to threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. That's everything, right?
That's it.
Okay. Here we go. This never used to happen to the other fella. Beverage this evening?
No, that's nice. I need all my wits about me to remember the plot of this movie.
Yeah, I was going to have a beer. I'm like, you know what? It's too tired. Some of this movie didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I forgot what it was halfway through watching it. I was like, I honestly don't remember what's going on. So
I watched this movie. We haven't done this in a while because we had a week-long power outage on my end where I live. And then my son got sick for a week, and that was awful. So, like, you know, we just haven't had time to do this. And I started watching this maybe a month ago, and then I got back to it today. Like, I sat down, like, all right. And I started to watch, like, I'll just sit down from the beginning. I'll watch the whole thing and this way. And then I'm looking at it going, yeah, I remember this, and I also don't care. Oh. And I just began to jump and, you know, make my way back to the pretty much where I left off, kind of in the middle. Mm-hmm. And I didn't miss much. But, it's really kind of all over the map in some ways, and then it just drags like the Dickens at points where it shouldn't, and I don't know. I mean, this movie is different than other Bond movies, and in a way, that in and of itself is kind of a good thing, because the formulaic business can get tired, but it also, you know, so that it was different can be good, but it didn't, it's kind of different, so I don't think made it a whole lot better. So there's a lot going on here. What'd you think?
I didn't like it at all. I really didn't like this movie.
Noted.
I thought it was dumb and awkward, and that so many things were happening where I wish someone was in the room with me, because I kind of like turn and be like, what is he doing now? Is he hanging out with this gangster? Is he like willing to take her off the guy's hands? Like, it was so odd. And the beginning of the movie too, when like he just sees a random woman who looks like she's trying to kill herself, and then he gets attacked. And it gets attacked again. Like, throughout the whole movie, goons just show up like a video game to, you know, break up the action sometimes. I was like, okay, this is very odd. And then they throw in the bizarre twist with Blofeld. And I was like, okay, now it's really weird, but they're still taking it seriously. And then it's over.
Yeah, they're very earnest about this.
Yeah, but not all the time. So I was bored through just huge chunks of it. And as we know, in today's modern society, there's a lot of things that can hold your attention. And I just felt like looking around, distracted, like, Oh, the movie, right. Yeah, the movie.
That's why we're here. Yes, of course.
Yeah, it felt like work.
Yeah, this one did sort of feel like an assignment, which isn't a good thing. So the plot of the film, from what I understand, is that he's just doing his thing. He's, James Bond, and he's new guy, and he wants to go after Blofeld because the idea is that he's still on the hot on the tail of a Blofeld from the last movie. And interestingly, the books do this in a different sequence. So in the books, this story happens first, where he meets this woman and they get married, and then Blofeld kills her, and then he follows Blofeld to Japan on. Which is like going to the ends of the earth in 1960 whatever, and he's on like a crazy mission to kill Blofeld, out of revenge for what he did to his wife. But for some reason they did them out of sequence, and so he's just looking for Blofeld. That's my thing. I'm looking for him, and M gets him off the scent and says no, don't bother going after her, and then this guy shows up. And the thing about these movies that I really like, and they did this too in Goldfinger, is that they all kind of mention that they're crime bosses. And I find that funny because it's like that scene from in Star Trek Deep Space Nine when Jake is tagging along with Quark for a day to learn what it's like to be a nefarious character. And Quark says to him, "Nobody involved in an extra legal activity thinks of themselves as nefarious. I'm a businessman." And that's something that was, it's just so over the top in here. It's just like, you're head of the largest crime syndicate in Europe. And he's like, "Yes, I know. I was number one before in the world, but now I'm only like it's kind of silly and goofy."
I mean, it's less believable than the later Bond villains who are clearly just like monomaniacal psychopaths. Like, I'm going to evacuate the people I like off Earth and blow up the planet so we can start a new space race. I'm like, well, that's a crazy thing. But at least he's not like, mustache twirling himself,
Yeah.
Like you're either a businessman or a psychopath. You can't be like a cartoony, like you expect these guys to have sacks of money with dollar signs on them behind them. Like, oh, add some jewels and money to my money bin, It's like they don't really talk like that.
It's pretty much as if he had a sign that said, "This is the villain,"
Yeah.
painted on his back.
I know I'm a bad person.
You can tell by my mustache
Yeah.
and my foreign accent. So, like, he meets up with this guy who can point him in the direction of Blofeld, and the guy wants him to marry his daughter
Yeah, she's high spirited.
because she's, and so he feels the only one who could handle her is someone like James Bond, and he offers her a million pounds to basically take my daughter, please. And he's like, "No, I can't," and then uses the guy to get to Blofeld, and then he kind of falls in love with her anyway, and then she rescues him from the really boring place on the top of the mountain. And like the second half of the film is just a very long chase,
Yeah.
punctuated by a wedding.
But there's also this bizarre plot in that Bond is looking for Blofeld, and Blofeld, who is a known criminal and is hiding in Switzerland, wants to be recognized as the heir of some, like, what does he want? Like, he wants a title.
And to be left alone, basically.
Yeah, I want to be called Comte Balthasar de Bluchamp, and he has to prove it to this guy at the London College of Arms. Like, they have to do a genealogical study. Why that's important to him, I have no idea, and it's never told. He wants that. I want to be called this for some reason.
Well,
So Bond has to pose as the guy and go interview him. I'm like, didn't you guys just meet? in the last movie.
Technically, you should know exactly who what he looks like.
Yeah.
I mean, neither of you are the same actor, but that really doesn't matter in the continuity of my brain.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, everybody in this movie wants something different. And that's really sort of makes it for a very disjointed tale.
Yeah, because then they add that ridiculous plot of the women who are the biological sleeper agents.
So he's going to hold the world hostage by convincing these women, who are all ridiculously hot, to come to his chateau and be hypnotized. And what are they going to do? They're going to
So he's
render
fixing.
everything infertile?
Yeah, like he's curing their allergy symptoms as the pretense for them, like when they go out there, they will set off like biological warfare that they're carrying in them somewhere.
That
That's what's ridiculous there.
part was unclear to me, how they were supposed to execute that plan. Like, I get it that they're brainwashed and they're, hypnotized and so, but like, what exactly are they going to do to accomplish that goal? Was it
Yeah, I don't know.
was that
Just be
stated and I
somewhere.
missed it?
I think they have to like take their medicine, or if they don't, then they will like send off bacterial stuff. This is why you use bombs and not people.
Yeah, oh, that's weird. So, yeah, and then the movie ends with a wedding where everyone is like off the clock. Did you notice
Yeah.
that? Like, everyone's just like, oh, so you're the guy that tried to blow up that thing last year. Oh, and yes, and you stopped me. And, oh, this guy got away with a good bit of that gold, too. And it's just like, okay.
Yeah,
I
it's
guess
very
we're all
odd.
chums if we're not really working. It's like when Wile E. Coyote and the runner were kind of clock out and get a beer. It's pretty much what that scene was. So, yeah, this, and I feel bad because my father-in-law loaned me the DVD and he's like, I'm curious to hear what you think because this is like one of my favorite ones and I like Telly Savalas' Blofeld and I actually thought he was a big improvement over the guy who played him in the last one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you only live twice, because he looked better bald than that guy did, and he was kind of serious. Like it just he could have been from any other like a current movie. It didn't look too cartoony. He didn't have that crazy eye thing. He was just a bald guy, has this great voice and
Well, this is where they start to mangle that character. Like everybody always, especially when Spectre came out recently, and they were making a big deal that they'd gotten the rights back to the character after so many decades, and they'd gotten a good actor to play him, and Bond was going to have like this nemesis again, but this character never really was much of a nemesis in that, like they personally hated each other, because he acts so different in all of them, and his motivations change so much. And then he kind of disappears, and he's not always the head. They never got a good job, did a good job with his character. And every time I see him, I'm like, like that. Bond doesn't have like a Moriarty type character. Like Blofeld doesn't really do it.
Yeah, and I think they tried to retcon that in the most recent movie by making him his foster brother or whatever it was. And I guess some people liked it, some people really didn't like it at all. I was ambivalent because I didn't really, I didn't have too much experience with Blofeld the character because I hadn't seen the movies that he was in. But I think they're in danger of doing this again. With the new Blofeld in the new movie, because it's with like with everything in these movies, it's a matter of logistics. They made so many of these things over so long with so many different people involved with the production and so many actors involved that you continuity was really hard. They also didn't care that much about it back then. And this was
Right,
like the
well.
first time that they, like I just watched the the documentary about this earlier today, just to prep for this, and they were saying like Saltzman and Broccoli thought like, we don't need Sean Connery. We could this the character is bigger than the guy. We can put anybody in there. And at first they were wrong because they got the wrong guy, I think, with Lazenby. But they eventually were correct about that. And that I think that enabled them, that thought process, to kind of be a bit more like lazy and haphazard with their characters.
Well, the problem with the Blofeld character is that he is entirely dependent on the movie he's in and the actor playing him, whereas all the other characters are not. And so they were right about that. Like, we could get Sean Connery, we could get, well, you know, George Lazenby wasn't great, but, you know, all the characters have specific traits that they have to follow in every single movie. So you could put a cardboard cutout in there and be like, that is the most debonair cardboard cutout I've ever seen. You know, he sure can talk to the ladies. But Blofeld's character changes from movie to movie.
Yeah.
So he's never quite pinned down. So whoever he's playing with at the time, you're like, oh, I guess he's like this now. I guess he's like that. Like, if you were to tell me exactly what this character is like, I couldn't tell you because it depends. And that's why I'm not sure. Like, why is it this? And they find that out later when they don't have him, that he's not really that important. Like, why is this person in charge of this enormous operation? Is he the smartest? Is he the most ruthless? I don't know. Not really. I mean, sometimes he is. It's that kind of a thing. Whereas Bond is always the same. Cruel, debonair. He can sex up the ladies. He's intelligent. Doesn't matter what body is occupying that character.
Yeah.
So they started doing that with Blofeld, and I was like, okay, I guess he's different now.
And I guess,
even though they already know each other.
Yeah, I guess that's ultimately the consistent problem that they have, is that why is he who he is? Bond, you kind of get. You get a little bit of the backstory. You know, his parents died when he was young. He was, you know, a maladjusted person and, you know, found himself in the Navy, and then they tapped him for service in MI6. And you kind of get why people will become spies, because everybody wants to be a spy. We can fill in his backstory with our own imaginations as to why you'd want to end up, you know, wanting to do that. And it's fine, but why you want to be a supervillain kind of requires more explanation, which is why we've always said that they end up being the better characters in most superhero stories, because they get a thorough backstory, and they're the person looking to change the status quo rather than looking to maintain it. So because you don't know anything about him, and because he keeps changing both in motivation and in with the actor, it's kind of hard to latch on to being afraid of the guy and, you know, really seeing Blofeld and Bond as having some kind of a connection.
Yeah.
Other than it's my job to go stop this guy, and that's what I'm going to go do. Mm-hmm. So they hang out in the Alps for a while, and then the chase starts, and the chase lasts for like 45 minutes.
Yeah, because he escapes from the Swiss thing they have, right? He like goes through the tunnels and the
big gears and out the, yeah, you know, and skis right. His way down, and somehow she helps him. She finds him, like he's like being chased, and like he looks like there's this moment where he's, you know, gets to that little village, and they're having some kind of a festival. And he puts on someone's jacket and is sitting by the ice skating rink, and she just skates up to him, goes, hello, I'm here. And what was interesting about that moment, I thought, was that he looked scared. Mm. And I'm not sure if that was what they were going for, because he's such a bad actor that you're really not sure if any of the things he does that were good were on purpose or not. And so he's sitting there, he's like, and he has this look on his face like, what am I going to do? They're like, I can't seem to get rid of these guys. There's too many of them, and they're really hell-bent on killing me. And then she skates up to him, and they get into his car, or her car, rather. And then she helps him escape, kind of.
And kind of.
Then they get into a car thing, and they spend the night in a barn, and they go skiing down a, you know, the skiing scene was cool. I absolutely like that avalanche thing. Mm-hmm. I actually thought that was pretty neat. You know, for 1969, you know, that kind of giant cinematography that they had there, it looked pretty great, I thought.
I thought it was well done in that it was like fairly realistic. You know, it was like he falls over and they beat each other up in the snow and stuff like that. Like he doesn't pop a button on his vest and it makes a little enclosure like some of the later movies.
I was thinking about that. Well, that was, I think, one of the greatest sins of the Pierce Brosnan movies was that they kind of like reverse engineered all the gadgets he was going to need. Like the best one is that in is the one in Tomorrow Never Dies, when he's driving the car around the parking garage, and like they set up this like, I don't know, what do you get, like a
Oh, like
tripwire, like
the steel cable.
a steel cable. And for whatever reason, the BMW logo pops up, and these two like razor saw or I don't know what you call them, buzz saws, are perfectly positioned to cut this cable right in half. I'm like, wow, they really thought of everything, didn't
You never know when you
they?
might need that. Where's
But
my
yeah,
jam trousers?
switch of trousers. Yeah, but the puffy coat that, why you'd ever want that to be a thing, I have no idea. But he didn't have that. He was, actually, come to think of it, he didn't really have any gadgets in this movie. I didn't really even think about that until just now.
And Q is in it, right? I can't remember. Q does give him something, though.
Don't remember either, actually.
Like they always give him the gun, and I think it's interesting in these early movies that they always mention that like he ha like who else uses the gun like this? Nobody. Only James Bond has a Walther PPK.
Which is stupid because then they'd all know it was you.
Well, yeah. Well, he also has the exact same face, and he tells everybody who he is, which is also not good.
Which I love how they reference that in Casino Royale. Like he walks up to the concierge of the hotel and tells him his real name. And like, why did you do that? He goes, look, if he knows who I am, then he's, if he's that well connected, he's gonna know who the hell I am. So why bother to pretend? Like, okay. And then she makes fun of him and like gets pissed off that his ego is so big. Which she's right. It is. It's ridiculous. So.
So I don't think Q really gives him much this time.
Yeah. No, like I'm not even sure he was in the movie, come to think of it. He must have been,
He
right?
was. He was there. He
He
was
was
in the
there.
end too.
Right, yeah. He was at the wedding.
And then the very tragic, cartoonish Boris and Natasha murder scene. I thought that was just so odd.
What, at the end?
Yeah. Not that she died, but that like the people driving the car were Blofeld and like that woman. When he's supposed to run this vast criminal empire with 8 bajillion henchmen. And they drive by like knuckles in your face on these little tiny European cars, and looks they look like the two Bullwinkle villains. Like, I got you now.
That's
And
true.
roll credits. I was like, oh man, that is so lame.
Yeah, see that bothered me most of all was that like they like you spend the whole movie where you think she's gonna die. Like she's in such peril the entire time. And he thinks about her differently than all the other girls.
For some reason.
Yes.
Because even though he loved her, he was sleeping with all those women.
That's true. Well, they were right there. So like I knew she died. And I'm watching it going, like, well, she doesn't die here, but maybe if you were, if you didn't know the end of the film, you would think at this point maybe she could actually go. That's not good. How would he feel about that? And finally, after all the hubbub and the wedding, they're just driving along, and next thing you know, gets, killed in a drive-by, and the movie just stops.
They had all the time in the world.
Ba-da-ba-da! Like it just goes right into the horns. I was like, wow, they really gave him not a time, not any time to breathe about it. And yeah, no, I thought that was, but I didn't think about it until just now. But yeah, the fact that it was just the same two people who happened to be driving along the same road.
In a Hugo. Like they couldn't catch up to him, I guess. I also don't know what the point of getting her, what was getting him married all about? Did you do any reading on that?
It's just from the books. He gets married, and she, like, this is the thing. Like, it, in a way, this is, I think, a good plot development for the character. You know, he does this insane job. He lives this insane lifestyle, the drinking and the women and the killing people, and you know, it's very exciting, but you can't, you know, you can't keep it up. It's exhausting. And he meets someone and he's really affected by her and he decides to hang it up. And he goes through with it. And the lifestyle won't let him. They, you know, they pull him back in kind of thing. And then he, you know, then like, you know, like I said, in the books he goes on a, you know, crazy mad revenge chase after this to go get Blofeld. But I mean, it's, I mean, you can't write the same book over and over again. You can make the same movie over and over again, it turns out, but you can't write the same book over and over again. And so this was a way, I guess, for him to give the character some depth and some new obstacles to kind of deal with. So, which, I mean, I appreciate it. I just, it, you know, didn't come off very well because that's not what the movie's about for, you know, a good 48% of it is about something else. She's not in it that entire time he's in that clinic in the Alps, and that chunk of the film seems to take forever.
Yeah, that part of the film is very slow.
Yeah.
And you know, and jarring. Like, to me, it was just very weird to have all these disparate, you know, themes and elements just all at the same time. I was like, I what happened to that girl? And like, there was the whole thing, I want to be a count. And then there was the stuff with Q where he's like, I'm retiring. And Q's like, no, you're not. Okay, you are. And just, it was like they forgot they were doing something halfway through and started doing something else.
We should get back to that. That was important from earlier.
That might come in handy later. Just we'll splice that in somewhere. Like,
Yeah.
okay.
So I have some notes, and they're kind of all over the place, but
Oh, like the movie.
yeah, a little bit. Like the fight, like the like I don't know what you call it. But the way the film was edited for the fight scenes and those
Oh my God, that's right. I texted you that. I'd forgotten all about that.
like that like Luke Kang uppercut he does.
He was doing uppercuts every other move. I was like, those
Yeah.
are not easy to do, and they miss very often, as I can tell you from my Mortal Kombat days.
it's a wildly inaccurate way to punch somebody. Because they have to be bent over just enough that you hit their jaw in such a way that they go flying up in the air.
Yeah.
And so,
And
like,
then that they were also like on super speed.
yeah, it's funny. Like, we really have to appreciate how well movies are made now. Even bad movies are made well. And so, if you go back and watch movies from like the 30s and 40s, and you go, Jesus, some, this isn't really. And like, chances are, if they had just had the savviness with the technology they have now, it'd be a whole different experience. But that's a whole big chunk of it. It's just like, technology didn't catch up to what they wanted to do, and they were also not that good at it yet. Combination of that, so it all kind of looks, you know, a lot of these this little mini series we're doing is all about how do these films hold up in terms of, because they're still making them and they've been making them for years. How do they, you know, do they measure up to what we're talking about in 2018?
Well, I mean, it was 1969, and the fight scene in From Russia with Love was much more interesting and I think better filmed. And it was very just brutal, like the two guys going back and forth between these two train cabins.
Yeah.
And it was like a 10-minute thing, and it was interesting. And all of these scenes, you could tell they were moving fast. Like, people don't move that quickly, and they look like chipmunks on a wheel. I was like, why are they moving so fast? And then I realized, oh, they sped up the film
Yeah.
to make it look like he was moving quickly.
Well, it's
But the
got
whole thing looked like that. I was like, wow, that is just a crappy, lazy way of doing this.
It's kind of like the Paul Greengrass, whatever. The guy does the Bourne movies
With a shaky cam.
with a shaky cam. Like it's a stylistic choice that they make to emphasize a certain point of view. Batman Begins kind of had the same thing. You never really saw him fight very much. You just saw like an arm and a leg come out of here. And the idea was that you couldn't see him. You were looking at it from the point of view of the guy getting his ass kicked. So if you're in it, if you have this kind of tight documentary style of filming, it'll make the audience feel more like they're more a part of the action. As we know now, that has its downsides. You know, I always think of that. I don't know why it was like a 10-minute thing. Was it George Martin, the guy who directed Mad Max Fury Road? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Sure. Anyway, but there was a thing where they were talking about the way that guy filmed the action sequences and how he was constantly telling the cameraman to keep the crosshairs on her face the whole time. Don't lose focus on this. Make sure we can see this. Mm-hmm. And it's become a split, a schism in the way people decide to shoot action movies. Do you do it this way to give the audience a you are there feel where they were going to throw up? Or do you do it this way where they can see everything but they're alienated from the screen more than, you know, if the camera was handheld and moving? You know, this is, I guess, the beginning of that, when they were just kind of making stylistic choices about how to shoot something, and they weren't that good at it yet, which is why they just sped up things and all of a sudden everyone's running really fast.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know what the reasoning was. I thought the reasoning was simpler, and that it's just we're trying to make the fight scenes more kinetic, as the jargon would probably go.
Yeah, probably.
So we speed up by 1.3, 1.4 speed. You know, like they don't have to look like a blur, but they have to look like they're competent fighters versus like you or I if we start fist fighting somebody.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're watching the movie in regular speed and that happens, it sort of jolts you like, huh? Like, you know, it makes you alert and aware of what's going on. So it takes you out of the movie.
Yeah. The car chase, too, I thought was a little bit, I didn't know what was going on there, who was in whose car. And I think there was like a separate director for the car chase bit. Mm. I had heard that somewhere that somebody else had an entirely different directing credit for just that scene where they're, you know, get caught in that random car chase going on in that Swiss town.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which is hilarious. But, yeah, so, like, I can see them trying to bring this into the, you know, into the modern age of filmmaking, I guess it was, at the end of the 60s, but it didn't, I don't know, hard to see things. And when you could see things, it looked kind of goofy. But so what else did I have here? The title sequence. The song is great, of course, because it's Louis freaking Armstrong. A little bit of a drippy song.
Yeah, very drippy.
But, you know, it's still Louis, so you can't. But the title sequence was really funny. It was all the old movies.
Yeah.
So here's this new guy, and he does that direct address to camera at the end of the... Which I really want to know why they did that.
I think they were just trying to... I think it was a jarring thing in that, you know, here's a new guy. We all thought it would be Sean Connery, and now you don't have your big star. And they were saying, well, we can do this without him, and we'll prove it to you. And so some of it was kind of like, you know, just relax, everybody. We got this. We can still do it.
Yeah,
stylistic choice.
I guess so. I just thought that like they're gonna have, you know, posters for the film, right? There'll be some like right now we get so much information from the trades and other magazines and things like that, or like on the internet about, you know, what's going on with a film's production, but not as much as, you know, not so much more than they did back then. But they would have, you know, told you they were casting a new actor to play the part, right? So, like, I can't imagine somebody going into the movie going, oh, it's a different guy. Like, if you were really, you know, a Bond fan, you would know that they got rid of Sean Connery. It would have been news.
Well, that's what I mean. There was probably a lot of waiting. Like, let's see if they can really pull it off, you know?
I guess so. It just was like, oh, all right.
Well, we have that now when it's like, who's going to be the new Bond, which I still don't know why we do. And then they always pick somebody, and a good number of people go, that guy? Really?
Yeah, well, they gave Daniel Craig such a hard time because of his blonde hair.
Yeah.
And
This bot is blonde and blue eyed. That can't be.
although
What?
it's funny when you look at his earlier roles and when you look at him in like that whole thing where they did the announcement where they had him like come in on a boat off the Thames or whatever, like this big press event. He's a skinny guy. And he was a skinny guy in layer cake and and then he gets enormous. I mean, really quite big to play James Bond and cuts the hair really short. And you didn't even notice that his hair was lighter than, say, Sean Connery's hair. Like he looked fantastic. And I was like, 'cause like I didn't know who he was at that point when they cast him for Casino Royale, and this is like the early 2000s. So then, when I finally saw him in the movie, I was like, oh, "He looked great. What the heck were they all bitching about? He looks fantastic." Also, the movie was amazing, so you really,
Well, I think
that
that's what
helped.
they were trying to show with this guy. It's like, oh, if the movie's good, it won't matter that it's not Sean Connery. Problem is the movie wasn't very good.
Oop, sorry, dropped something. Yeah, so didn't quite work out. That's pretty much all like my weirdo notes. Just the plot was kind of all over the place. What were those spikes on the wall was like the last thing I wrote down. Like
When
when
was
like
where was that from?
in the elevator next to the elevators when he's in like the clinic and he's coming in and out of the elevators. There's like these set of spikes on the wall that don't seem to be doing anything there. And then later on in the movie, he gets into a fight with the henchmen during like the dramatic gun battle, blow it up rescue scene. And I guess I can't think it was him or Tracy just takes a guy and shoves him on these spikes. Remember
No,
that?
I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, go back and look at it. Like there's this scene where like they're fighting in the hallway outside the elevators, and I guess it was Bond. And he takes one of Blofeld's henchmen and he shoves him back, and he gets impaled on like these maybe 6-inch spikes that are sticking out of the wall. And I'm looking at the wall earlier in the film, going, those look pretty dangerous. What exactly would they be doing there?
We still haven't had time to move that yet.
I mean,
We
it just
should really put that in the corner.
it's quite odd. And then next thing some guy gets impaled on him. I went, oh,
Oh, well, that's what it's for.
I get it. I get that now. Yeah. So.
It felt like they had one of those, because especially when you look at the last film with the You Only Live Twice, and they had all the goofy shit, like the piranha tank that people fall into with the trap door and stuff like that. It's like they wanted to keep doing that stuff, but they also wanted to have a serious love story too, apparently, so that it just doesn't mesh well.
Well, there's not too much goofy stuff in this. I mean, there's no piranha
No,
tank,
no.
there's no, shoe phone or whatever. Like it's not all that goofy. But yeah, there's just enough of it that like it's kind of hard to mesh that with like a hanging up my spurs kind of thing. And it works better in Casino Royale because she's part of the story in a much more integral way. She's like she they, like they're on the job together. They're doing this together. Here, her presence is just it's shoehorned in there. The guy approaches him and says, "Marry my daughter, I'll give you $1 million." And he goes, "Well, no, but I want you to tell me where Blofeld is." And then he meets her and he likes her. But then she vanishes for an hour. And then magically shows up again when he's in trouble, and she helps him. And then he is trying to get M to get MI6 to go after her because she saved my life, and she owes we owe her a debt, kind of thing. Like, I guess, but what was she doing in that Swiss town? Just she's not a part of the plot unless she needed to be for the reason of getting them to the wedding scene at the end, and then nothing comes of that too in the long run. Like we hated Quantum of Solace, but that had to do with the fact that in the previous film he lost this woman, and it was a big deal. And it kind of it follows him throughout the other movies. Inspector too, you know. Blofeld brings it up there and says, like, you know, I've been involved with the death of all these people. And then when he goes into that, like, secret room with the French girl in Tangiers and finds a tape that says, like, Vesper Lynd, I guess it was her interrogation tape. He takes it and kind of goes, okay, well, and then, like, they make a point to say that he notices it and then puts it aside. So kind of saying to the audience, okay, he's done with her now. Now he likes this girl kind of thing. Does this ever come up again? Do you know? We'll find out in subsequent films, but, like, losing this woman after getting married never seems to bother him in the later films.
I think he visits her grave in one movie.
Yeah, I can't think of it. I think that was a Roger Moore film, too.
Yeah, but it doesn't, like, they don't mention her or anything like that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like, it wasn't, the later movies aren't that kind of thing.
Right.
So.
They really were kind of just serialized and not serialized, but you know what I mean. Like they didn't. There was no strong connection between films. They were just like, this is a new adventure with this guy, and mm-hmm. Yeah. So
what did you? What do we think about the Lazenby?
The story of how he gets the role is great, and if you're listening and you haven't seen Everything or Nothing, the James Bond documentary, it's on as of this recording, it's on I think Amazon Prime for streaming. It was on Netflix a while back, and it's a really great documentary, and you know, just kind of goes over this whole chunk where basically Sean Connery felt he wasn't getting paid enough. Which I'm sure was true because the two producers were raking it in, mm-hmm. And he knew he was the big draw, so he quit and they got this guy, and this guy literally had no acting experience, nothing. He was a male model who decided he was going to go for this part and just did everything he could, bought a suit, went to the same barber as Sean Connery, you know. Cut his, got the Rolex and just, you know, made himself look like James Bond. So when he walked into the audition, he would just look like James Bond. And they go, okay, well, we'll just cast you because you look great and it's fine. And that's literally what happened. It's hilarious. The guy just, you know, he made up some nonsense. I've been acting in Germany and this place and that place. And he gets on set and he has a panic attack. He tells the director, he's like, I've never done this before. And he's like, what the hell are you talking about? You've never done this before. He's like, yeah, no, I made all that shit up. And he's like, okay. Well, you fooled these guys. You must be pretty good at something. And that was it. So, I mean, it's clear he has no talent. He has a lot of charm, though. It's just kind of like raw charisma. He's in great shape, for Christ's sakes. I mean, his clothes. This guy makes the puffy shirt look good.
Yeah,
you know, I thought that was impressive. But overall, I mean, he's—I don't know—I haven't seen Timothy Dalton's films, so I can't, you know, I can't say overall who's if he's better or worse than any of them. You know, and Pierce Brosnan got a little goofy there at the end, so he's not terrible. But I also know a lot about him, so I'm kind of handicapping him a lot by, you know, figuring that they took this guy out of nowhere, put him in these movies, gave him a ton of money and a ton of girls, and he said I was drunk all the time. It was just a giant party for me that I pulled this off. So given everything I know, like, it's pretty impressive that he was able to churn out a performance at all.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah, I don't know anything about him. I just... only going by screen presence alone, and that he has none. He has nothing. He's completely blank in every scene.
Yeah, he's just kind of...
He's just a good-looking guy, and at that point, it's the movies. Everyone's a good-looking guy except the villain. So it's not as impressive, because he's also wearing those big puffy shirts. It's not like he's shirtless at any point. like Daniel Craig might be or something like that. And so he gives off no personality, you know. He doesn't smile really. Like his smiles feel cold and his jokes are flat.
Jokes are
And
really flat, yeah.
you know, he's like supposed to love her, but he has no acting ability, and so all he does is sort of stare at her, you know, and it's kind of like, is he admiring her like a painting, or is he actually supposed to be in love with this woman?
He also was dubbed for half the film.
Yeah, you can tell
Like,
that he's not sure what even, like, the lines don't seem to match his face.
no, well, no, that's he's doing an impersonation of the guy he meets at the college in London, and they got that guy to dub all of his lines. So when he's impersonating the guy,
He sounds the
they're
same.
using his voice, which is stupid. And it further makes him look bizarre on screen because, like, yeah, that's not quite his voice, and he's not putting it on, but it doesn't sound right. And yeah, that was that I thought was a pretty big error because he looked like that guy when you put the glasses on him,
Sure.
And
It's just.
although Blofeld mentions, like, if he hadn't started running around banging all the girls that are here, we wouldn't have noticed that you weren't this guy.
Yeah. I think it's funny that he gets caught because he's always busy with them.
That's
But
hilarious.
so he gives off, you know, it's boring in terms of the plot, but it's boring to watch him because he can't act.
No, like, he does have a lot of silent charisma. Like, he doesn't, like, whenever he talks, it's worse. But, like, when he's sitting there at the table, they're playing Chemin de Fer. He just kind of smiles and looks like he's having a great time. Like, that part is fine, but then he begins to talk, and it's just kind of like, oh, all right. You just,
I guess. Even then, it didn't work for me. I was just like, oh, this guy doesn't even look like he wants to be there either.
yeah. I
Okay,
mean,
now smile, George. You're having fun. I am having fun.
no,
So,
not a good actor.
and so why did he leave after one?
They fired him.
Now, see, I heard that I've heard many different things.
Well,
This is like the fourth explanation now. That's funny. Because
I
I don't
mean,
really know, so.
he went a little bit off the deep end. He got involved. This is according to him in the interview in this documentary. He got involved with a counterculture guy. Can't think of his name. And he shows up to the premiere of the film with long hair and a beard. And they were like, "What are you doing, George? You can't, like, you're supposed to be James Bond. The movie's premiering. You look like a fucking hippie." Because he was. He got into this whole, like, subversive culture, and he wasn't going to listen to them. This guy, it's really funny. If you look at his story, he basically was handed the keys to the kingdom and totally just threw them out the window. He was a nobody print model who wormed his way into the only big blockbuster franchise that existed at the time, got this huge part, made a whole movie, and didn't seem to care about maintaining any of it. He said, "I was drinking the entire production. I was banging four or five girls a day." Like, people encouraged him too. It wasn't entirely his doing, but his behavior was so reckless. And then when the production wraps and he gets involved with these people who, put funny ideas in his head about this and that, and he makes some odd decisions. And I forget what the, you know, what I mean, he put it that they didn't ask him back because of the way he behaved. But he seems to have a lot of regret about that, and as well he should, because he could have had a career here, and he just didn't. So, yeah, I'm not sure what the official reason why it was that he just did the one, but all of this must have been part of that process. So, I mean, these guys weren't saints, but they at least knew how to, stay sober and show up on time.
Well, because I've seen it in interviews where he's just said, I just didn't want to do it. You know, I didn't like doing it. It was difficult. I didn't really get it anyway. I don't, you know, why do six or seven of these things when I don't really want to do it? And then I've heard other times where his agent told him to get out, and they're like, oh, you know, this isn't going to be popular later anyway. It's, I mean, by this point, it's almost a 10-year franchise. So do something, you know, let's do something else. And of course, he never worked again. And so I've heard many different, and nobody seems to like know for sure. It must probably a combination of all of them.
I mean, Wikipedia says that, you know, he said he didn't want to do it anymore. You know, Desmond Lewin says, like, how could you expect this guy who's never acted before to do this? It's, you know, kind of it. And he also, you know, he did become a hippie, and so, like, Bond was the antithesis of everything that the hippie culture stood for. So
Yeah.
if he had any investment in that for real, even if it was temporary, you know, it didn't mesh with this character at all. So
So I don't know. And I think it's best that he didn't do it. Because I don't know if people would have kept going to see these things. You know?
yeah, he might have killed it. I mean, maybe he would have gotten better. I don't know.
Couldn't have gotten worse.
No.
So.
But yeah. So not a good one.
No, this one I think I actually just didn't. I didn't like this one at all.
I think it could have been better. Like, it just so many things went wrong with this movie. I thought that Telly Savalas was a good choice for Blofeld. If you have to look at the film as a microcosm, I mean, if you go into it knowing a bit about the character, fine. But then, like, you know, if Bond had been the same, if Blofeld had been the same actor, you know, in a series of films, that would have been helpful. And the idea that you give up what you're doing for a woman and then you lose her in a very tragic way, that's a good story. It's the story of another James Bond movie, in fact. But excuse me. But it was just executed so poorly, and so I applaud the fact that they wanted to do something different with the character rather than just, you know, okay, Bond, here's your gun and your radio and your funny thing, and
I guess that's what it is. Oh yeah, I honestly don't. I don't know what the point of this movie is. What was the story they were trying to tell me?
I
Is
think.
that what that he falls in love and doesn't want to do it? Is that he has to impersonate people and still catch the guy who, you know, has like a revenge tale? Like, what was the point of this film?
I think they were really leaning on the wife angle, because it was so bizarre that, I
Like,
mean,
why didn't they just do that then?
well, right. I mean, think about the last movie when he's in Japan and how unbelievably misogynist that film was, even for the time. It was really kind of over the top. So to go from that to he meets a nice girl and settles down in a kind of interesting way, to have this guy approach him and say, "Listen, I want you to take my daughter out. She's crazy, and you're just as crazy as she is." You know, that must have been bizarre to audiences back in 1969, having watched this guy, you know, bang six girls a movie very casually, you know, and then kind of hang up the spurs and give up the lifestyle. But you're right, that doesn't really, you know, that isn't the bigger part of the film. The bigger part of the film is this kind of meandering plot with Blofeld, where you really don't know what he wants or why he would want. Like, I get why he would want to, you know, look for a full pardon, because he's like, okay, I'm tired of being chased around by all these spy agencies. So here's what I'll do: I'll threaten to kill everything unless you leave me alone. All right, fine, but then why the whole business about the heraldry and your title? Like, what? Like,
That I have no idea what I was doing there.
I mean, I can, you know, very generously say maybe he wanted some respectability. Now he was going to retire and get a full pardon, and I'll walk around as the count and whatever else.
But then why with the biological warfare? So
Well, that was the backup plan, just in case that they weren't going to do it. I'll kill everybody. Everybody.
The only thing I liked getting out of that was the coat of arms that said, "The world is not
World's
enough."
not enough.
And I sort of dragged that out for later, in a later movie. I was like, "Oh, that's right. That's where that comes from."
Yeah, with his four balls.
Yeah.
What the hell was it?
Quite manly, isn't he? So no, I didn't like this film.
No. Bond is back with Connery in the next one. I can't. What's the name of the next one?
Isn't that Diamonds Are Forever?
I think so, yes. I think you're right.
That one I've seen quite a few times.
Have you?
TBS on the Superstation used to play that one a lot.
He looks old in that one too. I've seen some clips and I'm like, huh, he look a little aged.
Yeah, that's when it started to get, you forget that they were cranking these things out like every 2 years.
Yeah.
It's not easy to do. That
Yeah,
would be
no.
tough for anybody.
I mean, now it's like three or four, and like the film itself, like the production shoots for like 8 to 9 months.
Yeah.
These films did not take that long to shoot. They took longer than I think a lot of movies made at the time. But, and that's just the principal photography. That isn't even, all the post-production stuff and the previous stuff. And oh, man.
Yeah. Diamonds Are Forever, 71. Live and Let Die, 73, 74. That's a lot.
I mean, three films in 4 years.
Right?
That's amazing.
Give the people what they want.
All right, so
All right. Well, we'll get to that one
eventually.
eventually.
Okay, we're gonna do our best to get to Death Wish because I forgot it was out already. I thought it was coming out later.
Everybody
So
did because it's not good.
it's not
That's
good.
what they tell me.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm curious.
Yeah,
But
we're trying to get out of the muck that is the early year and get to the good movies.
yeah, so I have to wade through a bit more. But you should look out for that. And in the meantime, if you haven't done so already, you should go over to iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher or TuneIn Radio, and you should subscribe. You should leave a rating or a review. Just search for Three Drinks in Podcast. You'll find us. You can find us on Twitter at Three Drinks in Pod. That's at the number 3 Drinks in Pod. Three Drinks in Podcast on Instagram and on Facebook. And you can email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. That's it, right?
That's it.
Okay. Fantastic. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.